You're listening to the Taylor Marshall Show, episode 121, Your Virtue of Temperance. We look at sexual sins, gluttony, and we even at the end look at St. Thomas Aquinas's look at women and the way they dress in order to be sexually attractive, whether or not this is sinful, and how it relates to marriage and husbands and wives. You're not going to want to miss this in today's episode. Howdy, and thank you for tuning in to the Taylor Marshall Show. This is the podcast for everyone who wants to create daily habits and learn enough theology to take their faith to the next level. My goal this week is to talk about the virtue of temperance. So far, we've looked at the four cardinal virtues: prudence, justice, fortitude, and today, temperance. Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome back to the Taylor Marshall Show as we conclude our series on the four cardinal virtues: prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. And I think temperance, today's topic, is one that touches each one of our lives and touches perhaps our daily struggle the most, because it relates to sexuality, it relates to food, it relates to the way we dress, the way we think, the way we speak of ourselves. It refers to our studiousness, according to Thomas Aquinas, our curiosity. It relates to drunkenness, even by extension to drugs and getting high. All these things under the virtue of temperance. So we have a lot to talk about today. I've tried to filter it down to the most interesting and important topics. Of course, as usual, I'm using St. Thomas Aquinas as my guide. And if you'd like to follow along with me, break open your copy of the Summa Theologiae of St. Thomas Aquinas. And we are in the second of the second part, the Secunde Secunde, in the Summa Theologiae. And we are beginning today at question 141, where Thomas launches his investigation and description of temperance. Now, what is temperance? Well, it's a virtue. As we've learned before, virtues are habits. They're not actions. Actions are actions. A virtue is a series of actions. So if you do something prudential, or if you do something just, that's not a virtue. If you do it 100 times, or even 1,000 times, or 1,000,000 times, that's a virtue. So if you say your prayers at night, every single night, maybe you miss every once in a while because you're sick or a late night or travel, but you do that every night, you've created a virtue in your prayer life, a habit. If you go to Mass every single Sunday, as we're asked to as Catholics, you've created a pattern, a habit, a virtue. So temperance is the virtue of moderation. It is the virtue of saying no, not only to bad things, but also too much of a good thing. And Thomas Aquinas, he cites Augustine in question 141. Then he goes on to say, I answer that as opposed above, it is essential to virtue to incline man to good. Now, the good of man is to be in accordance with reason, as Dionysius states. Hence, human virtue is that which inclines man to something in accordance with reason. Now, temperance evidently inclines man to this, since its very name implies moderation or temperateness, which reason causes. Therefore, temperance is a virtue. So Thomas is pointing us to moderation. Not too much. Also, as we'll see, not too little. And then he looks at the contrary vices to temperance, and we're going to break those open, not all of them, but we're going to look at several of them today. And then he goes into their opposites. So we'll start off here with shamefacedness. This is at question 144. This is showing shame, being ashamed of things. And Thomas says, is this virtuous? And his answer is no, it's not. to be ashamed may be a proper response in the context of repentance or dishonor, doing something dishonorable, but being ashamed is not a virtue. Which I thought was kind of interesting the first time I read this, because sometimes, especially like in children, we can see their shame and somehow think that this is virtuous. I think we need to be careful about that and realize that shame in itself is not virtuous. There are better ways to express repentance or correction than shame. He talks about honesty. He says, is honesty, whether honesty is the same as virtue. And he says, honesty is the same as virtue. And this kind of goes back to, I'm not aware if Thomas knows this or not, but if you go back to Cicero, actually, I think Thomas does know this, because in reply to objection one, he does quote Cicero on this topic. And Cicero speaks of virtue in an old Roman way, using the word honestus. I mentioned this in a previous podcast. I kind of like it because it relates virtue with honesty or with honor. Virtue, as I've talked about in a previous podcast, is related to the Latin word vir or vir, which means man. So it's associating virtue with manliness, whereas in the old Roman way, virtue was associated with honor or honesty. And so Thomas is kind of playing on the etymology here, and he says that it is, in fact, virtue, honesty, based on this old tradition, and he does, in fact, cite Cicero there. He goes on to talk about abstinence, and this is something that confuses Catholics. We have abstinence, which he talks about in question 146, and then we have fasting, which he talks about in question 147. What's the difference? Well, abstinence is abstaining from a certain food or a certain drink. And fasting is, in fact, giving up all food, all drink. So in a certain sense, abstinence is a subspecies of fasting. So, for example, in Lent, when we don't eat fish on Friday, that is a form of abstinence. You could call it fasting, but technically it's a form of abstinence. If you didn't drink alcohol, that would be a form of abstinence. It's just saying no to something. Also, not being sexually active, in English we call a form of abstinence. Now, the opposite of abstinence, according to Thomas, question 148, is gluttony. Now, gluttony we all know as eating too much. But Thomas breaks down gluttony further. And this is important for us as Catholics to understand gluttony and to teach this to ourselves, our friends, our family, our children. Because it's not just eating too much. It's eating with too much delicacy and eating at the wrong times. So for example, if someone puts food in front of you and you begin eating it without praying and asking a blessing on the food, showing your gratitude, that's a form of gluttony, because the food in front of you is taking the priority over your spiritual life, over your mind. So here, food is trumping reason. That's gluttony. Even if you don't eat too much, you know, maybe it's just, you know, you start to nibble and then you pray. You got a problem there. You know, in our family, this is a big problem, because we have 8 kids, teenagers down to a 1-year-old, and the teenagers, just like the little ones, and even myself, Dad, sometimes we nibble because it takes a long time to get everybody to the table, to get all the food on the table, to set the table. People are hungry. I get hungry. And so there's a temptation to begin to nibble on the food. You know, put your finger in the sauce, grab a roll, get a little bit of rice, dip a chip, whatever it is. And so I learned this from one of my friends. What they do is they say the prayer, bless us, O Lord, and then they count to 10. Now, we don't do this when we're out to eat or we have people over at the house, but when we eat in the dining room in the evenings and we're all together, we say the prayer, and then we count out loud, and the teenagers roll their eyes because they think this is so stupid, but the little kids love it, and we count to 10, and that's just to make sure that nobody eats. It's just kind of like a breather, like we said a prayer, let's just wait, and then we count to 10, and the little kids love counting to 10, and then we eat. It's just a reminder that our lives don't revolve around the food. Food's important. We need it to live, but we don't want to be controlled by the food. So eating too much, eating the wrong time, and then eating with too much delicacy. That is, you know, being a hedonist, being Epicurean, being too fussy about the wine served or the gourmet food or the right kind of truffles or whatever it is. Being too fussy over food is also gluttony, because the food is taking a priority in your life instead of being something that's to be enjoyed and to give you the strength to live out that day. It becomes the top priority. And for Thomas Aquinas, that's disordered, that's wrong, that has to be corrected. In fact, he says it's a sin. That's our tradition as Catholics. So that's gluttony. It's the opposite of abstinence. And of course, if we struggle with this, it's something that I struggle with, the answer in the Catholic tradition, and for Thomas, is to begin to insert its opposite. So if you struggle with gluttony, you have to insert abstinence, which means you say, okay, from now on or for this month, I'm not going to put salt on my food. Or for this month, I like bread, I'm not going to eat bread. Or for this month, I'm not going to use ketchup. These are little things, but by making these little rules and saying no to something so small, you're giving strength to your rationality, to your soul, to overcome the desires, the little tiny desires, the foxes of your carnal appetites. All right, next he looks at sobriety and drunkenness. Obviously, being drunk is not just a sin, it's a mortal sin. I did a whole video of this on YouTube on alcohol, marijuana, and drugs, in particular looking at marijuana because it's so controversial, and whether or not it's sinful for the Christian. I'll give you the 30-second version. Basically, our greatest gift as humans from God, other than Christ and salvation, on the natural level, is that God gave us an intellect. We have rationality. We're not like a goat or a lizard. We have an intellectual soul. We have a mind. If we do something to inhibit or destroy that great gift in us, our intellectual capacity, it's a mortal sin. What happens when you get drunk, or what happens when you get really high? Does your intellectual capacity go up or down? It goes down. In fact, if you get really drunk, you start acting like an animal. You might start copulating like an animal. You might start going to the bathroom like an animal. You might start behaving around food and property like an animal, destructive. You might start losing your conscience and your sense of right and wrong. You become reduced to an animal. You start fading away the intellectual faculty of your soul. So what's wrong? Sobriety is something that we as Christians need to embrace. I think sometimes we as Catholics think, ha-ha, all those evangelical Baptist people, they don't drink, we drink. Yeah, let's drink. Yeah, drinking's fun. And sometimes it can get pushed too far where we Catholics think, you know, being drunk or drinking a lot is kind of funny. It's not. It's bad. We need to call it for what it is. You know, or we think like, oh, the idea of a whiskey priest or a priest that drinks too much is kind of funny. It's not. It's no good, right? We need to embrace sobriety, because by embracing sobriety, we embrace temperance. He then goes on to talk about chastity, virginity, and lust and continence. A lot of people are confused on this, about the word celibacy, chastity, and continence. Let me break them down for you real quick. Celibacy is not having sex. Celibacy is not being married. That's what celibate means. You're not married. Chastity means that you live according to God's decrees for your state of life. So you could be a married person, a man or a wife, and be having sex with your spouse every day in accordance with nature and the teaching of the church, and you could be chaste. You'd be living in a state of chastity. You wouldn't be celibate. You would be chaste. And then there's the term continent. Continent means not having sex. So you could be married, but because your spouse is sick or because you want to delay the birth of your next child, you could live in a continent fashion where you do not have sexual intercourse. You wouldn't be celibate. See, like some people might say, oh, my wife and I are celibate right now. No, that doesn't make any sense. The fact that you're married means you're not celibate. What you want to say is we're continent right now. It's a period of continence where no sex is happening. And then virginity, of course, is the state of never having a sexual or not yet of having a sexual experience. That's what it means to be a virgin. So those are all the terms that Thomas, and he goes through the parts of lust and so on and so forth. I don't think we need to do it here, but I think that vocabulary is something that we need to study and we need to understand. Okay, so just for review, celibacy, not married. Chastity, living in accordance with your vocation. So if you're a nun, being chaste means no sex, whatever. If you're Catholic priest, celibate Catholic priest, that means no sex ever, right? If you're a married person, that means sex only with your spouse according to the norms and rules of nature and the church. And then there's continence, which is not having sex at all. And this could be a married person, a single person, a celibate person, religious, whatsoever. Okay, then he looks at clemency and meekness. It's often said meekness is not weakness. Moses was a powerful man, and yet Moses was said to be meek. Meek is just understanding who you are in God's great story. Not thinking too high, not thinking too low, having a proper understanding of who you are. Clemency is being merciful. Now, what's opposed to meekness and clemency? For Thomas Aquinas, it is the sin of anger. Anger is not always sinful. As a passion, anger can be used for a right purpose. You can think of a mother being angry and defending her child against someone who's trying to hurt her child. You can think of a soldier who, in a just war, goes out to fight the enemy and has a just anger or a just wrath. You can think of Christ in the temple expelling the money changers with a braided whip. There is anger there, but it's a righteous anger. Here, this is sinful anger, and sinful anger is identified by being opposed to clemency and meekness. So this anger is opposed to mercy, and it's opposed to the humility of righteous anger. So this anger has within it pride. And that's, I think, how you can tell in your own life or as you're preparing for confession or doing an examination of conscience, is my anger here righteous or unrighteous? All you have to do is ask yourself, is mercy a part of my anger? And is humility a part of my anger? Or is this stemming from pride? That right there is the litmus test on anger. Thomas then moves into, well, he talks about cruelty. I think that's pretty obvious how it relates to anger and how it's opposed to clemency. Then he gets into modesty and the various species below modesty. Modesty isn't just about clothes you wear. It's about the way you think, the way you speak, and the way you act. And what it is it's humility in action. Let me say that again. Modesty is humility in action. Modesty is the destruction of pride in action. So the way you think, if it's opposed to pride, that's a modest way of thinking. The way you speak, if it's opposed to pride, that's a modest way of speaking. And the way you act, if it's opposed to pride, that's a modest way of acting. So Thomas then links this up, kind of a genius here, it's really cool, with Adam and Eve and the very first sin, the very first temptation, and how it relates to pride. Ultimately, pride, we learn from Thomas, is opposed to this great virtue of temperance. If you struggle in pride, you will struggle with the other sins opposed to temperance. And I've been blessed in my life to have gone to confession to some holy priests who were well-trained in Thomas Aquinas and who were able to show me in my own life, my own soul, how certain sinful patterns in my life related to the other virtues or lack thereof. What Thomas does here in the second part of the Summa from questions 141 to 170 is he paints a picture for us. You could even say he creates a mosaic showing how pride leads to sins against temperance, namely drunkenness, sexual sins, incontinence, and anger. So let's say you're a priest listening to this and you have a penitent who comes to confession, and 90% of the confession is about sexual sins, drunkenness or sobriety, and anger. All of those things are symptoms of pride. Pride. So pride is leading the person to drunkenness. Pride is leading the person to lust. Pride is leading the person to anger. Just think about anger, for example. Anger usually bubbles up in our souls when we don't get what we want. You know, how could that person say that to me? Do they know who I am? They had no right to say that to me. You can already see how pride is at the root of that anger. If someone were meek, if they were mild, if they had humility, they wouldn't be bothered by what someone thought or said. The pride wouldn't bubble up. Anger wouldn't come. Also, when it comes to lust, so much of the sins of lust are about the domination of another person or to prove to oneself that you are sexually attractive and therefore sexually valuable. Again, a form of pride. So I think this is really neat how Thomas concludes this section on temperance with a study on Adam's original sin and the punishments of sin. And Thomas will say that if a person becomes very prideful, remember, God resists the prideful, we learn in Scripture. Even if that person is Catholic, even if that person's a Christian, even if that person is a priest, even if that person is orthodox and has memorized the whole catechism, that person is prideful. God will resist the prideful. He will resist you. And Thomas says that the way God graciously deflates the prideful person, and this scares me to the bones, the way God deflates the prideful person is usually through sins, sexual sins of the flesh, because they are the most embarrassing and the most shameful. Nothing deflates pride, especially spiritual pride, religious pride, as does the exposure of sexual sins. And so Thomas makes this connection. I think if you look through the history of humanity, you look at the Old Testament, even in men like David, and you look at maybe even the last few decades in the Catholic Church, and the pride of clergy and the hierarchy, and then sexual scandal. You see this replayed over and over and over. You even see it in the fall of Adam and Eve. Immediately there's a form of sexual shame and their need to cover their genitals right there in the first few pages of sacred scripture. And then, as I mentioned in the intro, and we'll close up with this, he talks about the adornment of women. Is it a sin for women to want to look attractive? This has been a big controversy over the past 2,000 years. In fact, Tertullian in North Africa will say that it's a sin for women to wear cosmetics. Even Clement of Alexandria, I believe, not a saint, but an early church father, says that women wearing cosmetics and dyeing their hair and styling their hair is sinful. And we see with nuns, one of the things nuns do is they don't wear makeup traditionally, and they usually cut off their hair and have short hair beneath the veil as a sign of renouncing their pride. And so all of this raises the question of the outward attire of women and whether it is prideful. Is it against temperance? Thomas Aquinas wants to answer this question, and he places this topic under the heading of modesty. And he says modesty is displayed in words and in deeds. We already covered that. But then he dedicates an entire question, question 169, to the outward attire of women. Let's take a look at what he says. He has two articles here. And in the second one, he wants to know, do women, here's the direct quote, do women sin mortally by excessive adornment? Do women sin mortally? So women, are you committing a mortal sin when you just look so good on Sunday morning before you head out to Mass? Thomas says, as regards the adornment of women, we must bear in mind the general statements made above concerning outward apparel, but also something special, namely that a woman's apparel may entice men to lust. According to Proverbs 7, behold, a woman meeteth him in harlot's attire, prepared to deceive souls. Then Thomas says, nevertheless, a woman may use means to please her husband, lest through despising her he fall into adultery. Hence it is written in 1 Corinthians that the woman that is married thinks on the things of the world, how she may please her husband. Therefore, if a married woman adorn herself in order to please her husband, she can do this without sin, even without venial sin. And it goes on there. I'd encourage, if you're interested in this, read the whole article. The gist of it is this. If a woman dresses in such a way to cause a man to lust, she is sinning. And Thomas here quotes Proverbs, and Proverbs specifically says harlot's attire. This is dressing like a street woman. A street woman, a prostitute, has a strategy of marketing. Just like McDonald's wants to show you, you know, a really nice hamburger with hot, crisp French fries and everything that goes along with it and the cold cola so that you pull over and order a combo meal. The prostitute also has a marketing strategy, and she wants to show you the goods so that a man will purchase. She wants to incite lust, just like McDonald's wants to incite hunger. So for a woman to do that, she is sinning, even mortally sinning. But Thomas, especially as it regards to wives, say that wives have an obligation to look good for their husbands. I think this is so interesting because we're talking about the 13th century, 1200s. People haven't changed that much, if at all. No, they haven't changed at all. People are the same. Thomas, and this is actually kind of controversial, I bet some of you will get mad at me for what I'm about to say, and you're going to write me an angry email or come on Twitter and say something mean to me, but that's okay. I don't mind. Thomas shows that there is an obligation. I think it's two-way. It's not just for women. It's for men too. That if we're married, we have an obligation to, as much as we can, at our age and our state in life, to remain physically attractive to our spouse. I like to work out and dress nice and comb my hair chiefly so that my wife thinks I'm attractive and says something like, "Hey, cutie," or "Don't you look handsome today?" I want to please her in that way because it's my vocation in marriage to make sure that she's still attracted to me. I have to try at it. Just because we said the vows doesn't mean we get to give up. That was only like 45 seconds of our entire life, and it was many, many years ago. There's still an effort. And then Joy, my wife, she does the same. She's very attractive. She looks good. And she shops for clothes and she does things with her hair and wears makeup and does these things so that I'm still sexually attracted to her. And I think that's virtuous, as Thomas says here. And it's something that is good and wholesome. You know, Saint José María Escrivá, the founder of Opus Dei, said the same kind of thing. And there's been people who have been critical, I think wrongly, of José María for this, because José María realized that part of keeping the spice alive in marriage is just trying. It doesn't mean you have to be a supermodel or you have to be the guy on the cover of one of those muscle mags or whatever. But just try, you know, keep yourself fit and try to look good. I had a mother of a few children. I spoke of this somewhere. I can't remember what it was. And a mother of some young children wrote me and said, "Thank you for saying that. I feel that way, but sometimes when I bring it up around other women, they judge me or they say that that's patriarchal or wrong and that we shouldn't be that way. But I really think it is important as a wife, and I think other women is too, to try to be attractive to my husband." I think, you know, just small things. I'm going to get in so much trouble saying all this stuff. Oh, well. Small things like when you hear your husband, you know, pull into the garage and you've been working all day and, you know, busy and you maybe haven't got ready. I think, you know, just, you know, put on a lipstick. Your husband's going to think, "Wow, she looks great." You know, just put on a little lipstick or, you know, just spray a little perfume on, put a little lipstick. Guys, you know, look in the mirror, comb your hair before you come out. Maybe put on a little cologne. You know, tuck in your shirt tails. You know, make sure your clothes still fit you. Get in shape. Go on a run. Lift. Eat less. You know, it's important that we represent the kingdom of God. It doesn't mean we have to be, you know, walking around in what Thomas calls harlot's attire, but we can be attractive. And I think that's important on Sunday mornings to look our best, not to look sexy. I'm not saying that, but to look respectable, to look our best, and then for spouses to continue to try to bring that attraction into the marriage. It's good. So there it is. I'm sure someone's ticked right now and can't believe that Dr. Taylor Marshall got out this 13th century medieval philosophy about temperance and said women should wear lipstick or whatever. But I think for the 95% of you, you know what I'm saying. And I think that that's part of being temperate is saying no to what's too much and then also saying no to what's too little. And I think that has to do with our appearance. It has to do with alcohol. It has to do with sexuality. It has to do with honesty and shame and pride and everything we talked about today. So there it is, your Christian virtue of temperance. It's in Thomas Aquinas, Summa Theologiae, second part of the second part, questions 141 to 170. All right, before we rush into the tip of the week, our Latin word of the week and our shout outs, have a few announcements. The first one is, as I said in the last podcast, this podcast is now available on YouTube. So if YouTube is an easier format for you to consume media and podcasts, you can go to my channel, Dr. Taylor Marshall, and we've now put the entire Taylor Marshall Show archives on YouTube. 120 episodes are now up there. A special thank you to Daniel Dewitt, who worked hard to get all of those on there. Thank you so much. They look great, they sound great, and it's another way to get the show. So check it out on YouTube. Also, I put a lot of videos up there with resources on Christian philosophy, Catholic doctrine and theology, church history. So please subscribe over at YouTube to my channel, Dr. Taylor Marshall. Also, my second novel, the sequel to Sword and Serpent, Sword and Serpent 2, titled 10th Region of the Night, is a bestseller. It's continuing to sell well. And in fact, the first novel, Sword and Serpent 1, took a huge bump in sales, I think because people realized the sequel was out and wanted to get the first one for family, friends, or maybe read it for the first time. So both of them are doing really well. I'd encourage you, if you're interested in Catholic fiction and you like saints and you like history, this is the novel for you. It's about St. George and his meeting up with St. Christopher and St. Nicholas and Pope Marcellinus and St. Helen and Constantine the Emperor, all during a time of persecution. And it's got some great reviews. So go to Amazon, check it out. The first book is called Sword and Serpent. Sword and Serpent. You can find it on Amazon or in the show notes for this podcast. Also, we will be bringing our enrollment for the spring into the new St. Thomas Institute to closure. So if you'd like to sign up for classes in an affordable way at the largest and most global, most international Catholic Institute for learning, that's us, the new St. Thomas Institute. We provide certificates in Catholic philosophy, Catholic theology, Catholic apologetics. We now have Catholic Church history and the Church Fathers. And this year, we are rolling out our medieval theology program. We just did classes on the schism between the Greek Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Church, on Filioque. We did stuff on Charlemagne and St. Bernard of Clairvaux, St. Hildegard, St. Dominic, St. Francis, St. Bonaventure, and St. Thomas Aquinas. We just filmed those a couple of weeks ago, and we'll be filming more. They'll be coming out every week. If you want to take online classes on your own time for a really low tuition fee, check it out, New St. Thomas Institute. The website is newstthomas.com, newstthomas.com. Saint is spelled out. Okay, the tip of the week is usually something that is spiritual or not spiritual, and this week it's not spiritual, and it is to stretch. Stretching daily. I saw Conor McGregor said that humans are the only animals that don't stretch when they wake up. You know, you ever look at a tiger or a lion or a horse or a dog when they wake up? What's the first thing they do? They stretch. Humans, we just get up, brush our teeth, get in the car, and cramp up our legs. So it's important that we stretch. I'm training for a sprint triathlon with my teenage son, and I'm realizing the older I get, the importance of stretching, of having loose legs, a loose neck, a loose back, and making sure that I stretch before workouts, after workouts. I'm also doing jiu-jitsu, and we do lots of stretching before and after. So I'd encourage you to make stretching part of your daily routine. If you're into fitness, obviously stretch before and after. And if you're not, just in the morning, get on the ground and do some basic stretches. You'd be amazed after just about 3 weeks how limber you can get from just some basic stretching, like some butterfly, touching your toes, pulling your arm across your chest or over the top of your head. Just these basic stretches, probably that you learned when you're in middle school, just apply those. You'll be amazed by how much limber your muscles feel and how much better you feel all the time, walking, sitting, driving, etc. So that's the tip of the week. Make sure you're getting your stretches in. Also, we have a gift for you. If you go to taylormarshall.com, free book on Thomas Aquinas. There's even a section in there on the virtues and some of the stuff we covered today. It's a 50-page intro to Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas, the greatest Catholic theologian and philosopher of the Catholic Church. People are intimidated by him, so I wrote a 50-page booklet to introduce you to him. And I want to apologize because I found out that that link was not working. Someone wrote me and said, hey, the link's broken for the free ebook on Thomas Aquinas, so we fixed that. The link now is working. So I apologize if last week or last show you went to get the free book and it wasn't working. Something happened on our host and that link wasn't working. It's back up. You can get the free book. Go to taylormarshall.com. com. Before the Latin word of the week, I just want to thank everyone who gave a shout out and rated this podcast over at iTunes. The best way that you can show your appreciation for this show is to go to iTunes and leave a review. I read all the reviews and I give a shout out on the podcast to everyone who reads a review. Not only does it give me feedback, but it helps other people find the show. The more reviews and ratings there are, the more iTunes shows this podcast to people looking for podcasts about spirituality, philosophy, Christianity, and Catholicism. So this week, I give a shout out to Shanna Green, who writes, "Dr. Taylor Marshall makes complex theological concepts accessible and understandable for non-academics." Thank you, Shanna Green. Also, M. Daw, thank you so much for your review. And Gigum, I saw M. Daw is also an Aggie from Texas A&M, as am I. So M. Daw, thank you, Gigum. Roscast left a 5-star review. Thank you so much, Roscast. And then Ludovicus left a 5-star review, and he wrote, "Dr. Marshall's podcast is a leading Catholic podcast. It's thoroughly Orthodox and presents tough and complex topics in a very approachable manner. Every Catholic wishing to deepen their faith and knowledge should listen. I cannot recommend it highly enough." So thank you so much for that review. That's the review of the week. And if you'd like to leave a review, please just go to my website, taylormarshall.com/shoutout. taylormarshall.com/shoutout. Takes about 15 seconds. It's really easy to do, and it would mean the world to me if you did that. All right, Latin word of the week is, you guessed it, temperantia. Temperantia. What does it mean? Temperantia means temperance. Yeah, but what does temperance technically mean? Well, temperance comes from the Latin word tempus. Tempus, which just means time. Tempus is time. But applied to a virtue, temperance is like keeping time in music. If you don't keep time in music, the entire symphony goes into disarray. Even if you're playing alone on the piano, if you can't keep time, can't follow the beat, the song gets all fouled up. And I think temperance is keeping time in your life. It's observing the seasons. It's the tapping of your foot, keeping time. It's keeping the rhythm of your life. And if you're going too fast with your food, eating too much, you know, or you're too obsessed with lust, with the sexual appetites, or I'm so important, I'm so prideful, which leads to anger, your life gets out of beat. You lose step. You trip. The music of your life falls into disarray. So temperance is that rhythm. It's keeping the tempus, keeping the time in your life so that everything falls into place and you make beautiful music. And making beautiful music is becoming a great saint. So that's your Latin word of the week, temperantia. Oh, hey, we got a visitor. Hi, what's your name? What? Elizabeth. Elizabeth? How old are you, Elizabeth?
Three.
Three, yeah. Do you like to interrupt podcasts?
I go to Target today.
You went to Target today?
No, I go to school.
Oh, you went to school?
Yeah.
Okay. You like to interrupt podcasts? Hmm? Do you?
Mm-hmm.
You do, yeah. Okay. Well, hey, you know what? I'm finishing up a podcast on temperance. Do you want to help me finish the podcast on temperance? All right, let's do it together, okay? All right, our Lord Jesus Christ said that you are the light of the world and the salt of the earth. So go out there and be salty. You like that? Here, say, be salty.
Be salty.